UNC Radio Total Theater Tony Special. You're on the air. Hello.
Do I win free tickets to Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
We really can't give those away. Well, actually, we can.
Give them away, believe me. There are plenty available.
Well, yeah, but not for free. The thing would be packed for 10 years. You know that. The person on the other end of this line, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is our first guest for the afternoon. I'm so thrilled that he called in right on time. In fact, 2 minutes early, so thank you. Thank you, Michael Riedel.
Yeah, unlike Spider-Man, which has delayed its opening now 6 times.
Do you think it's actually...
I'm not punctual.
do you think Spider-Man will, in fact, open on June 14th, 3 days from now?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I know that last night, Friday night, all of the major critics went in to see it, including Ben Brantley of the New York Times and our critic Elizabeth Vincentelli from the New York Post. So they were all in, and those reviews will be out on Wednesday.
Oh, wow. Okay. Did Brantley see it in its original incarnation, or did they say Isherwood, the second string?
No, Brantley saw it and panned it. I mean, I think he said it was one of the worst musicals he'd ever seen, and he was right.
Oh, so have you seen both incarnations or just the first?
I have, no. I've seen, God help me, I saw the first incarnation 2 or 3 times, and I've seen the second incarnation twice now. And I can give you my early review, which would be that the first version, Julie Taymor's version, was inept, pretentious, and boring.
Wow.
And the new version is just boring. So I guess that's an improvement of sorts.
Hey, so maybe if they close it and open it again in another 6 months, they do the Frank Wildhorn thing that he was doing with the Scarlet Pimpernel, and they take it
from
there.
That's right. Well, Frank Wildhorn had 3 versions of Scarlet Pimpernel. We're now at 2 versions of Spider-Man, but why not? I mean, they seem to have all the money in the world. They've now spent $75 or $80 million on this this colossal bore. So what's to stop them from retooling it yet again if they want to? And I think, frankly, I'm pretty sure the critics are not going to be impressed with the new version. It is, you know, it's clear. The plot now makes sense. Some of the dreadful numbers that Julie Taymor came up with are gone. But still, it's just one big, long, boring slog.
Well, would you say that if you hadn't already seen it 4 or 5 times? If you were coming totally fresh to it, right? Hadn't seen the special effect of flying off the ceilings, the web stuff, you know, because you're going to be bored because you know everything to expect. Do you think...
If I were seeing it for the first time, I would say about 15 minutes into it, I'd be looking for my blanket and my pillow.
Oh.
It's just not... No, I mean, first time, third time, fourth time. You're lucky if you only have to suffer through it once. It's just a bore. I mean, you know, the music is sludge. Bono and the Edge have not written a good tune in the whole thing. Ooh. It's all very lumbering music with very pretentious lyrics. The special effects, to my mind, aren't all that great. I mean, I've seen several versions of Cirque du Soleil, and they fly around in that, too, and they fly over your head. So there's nothing spectacular there. And the plot, which in Julie's hands was just bizarre and pretentious and loaded with references to Ovid and Homer and all the great Greeks that she reads. Now the plot is a very straightforward Spider-Man story. It's basically a ripoff of the Spider-Man plots from the movies.
So instead of going with Homer, they go with Marge and Bart, essentially.
Yes, instead of going with Homer, they've gone back to Stan Lee.
Thank you so much for that. Anyway, by the way, we're talking with Michael Riedel, who, if I have not mentioned yet, is the... No, you're not a gossip. You're a theater columnist, journalist, sort of a gossipy columnist for the New York Post, and your work appears every Wednesday and Friday, and nobody in the theater community misses it. You know, they love you, they hate you, whatever, but nobody does not read you. Well, that was a double negative. But
I often tell them what's going on in their own shows.
Do you ever hear?
I've got better sources than the people producing the shows.
Well, because you hang around at the bars and Sam's, and is Sam still there? Or where do you hang now?
Oh no, David, you're dating yourself. I mean, Sam's that whole area. Sam's was we should tell your listeners,
sure,
all three of them. Sam's was an old theater district bar and restaurant, popular with the theater crowd in the 80s and the 90s, but about 7 or 8 years ago now, that whole section of old townhouses that had those old restaurants there, they were all torn down, so Sam's is no more.
Oh, so where do you go to, where do the theater people hang now in New York?
Well, the hot spot is, has been for the last few years, though, is a place called Bar Centrale, which is owned by Joe Allen, who owns the restaurant that bears his name. Mm-hmm. And it's a real kind of theatrical club. There's no sign outside. You know, you have to know it's there. They're kind of particular about who they let in. And you know, I was there the other night, and this table is Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker, and at that table is Bono and The Edge looking ill because they must have must have been a critics' night there at Spider-Man. And then, of course, yours truly holding court in the back by the kitchen. I mean, that's where they put me, so nobody sees me, I guess. But that's the sort of center of it all. That's where we all go now. And Angus McIndoe, that's the Scottish guy who's been around Broadway a long time. He's kind of an old saloon keeper, and people go to his restaurant. And Joe Allen's is still a stalwart. So those are the three places that people hang out. And I feel that, you know, as a columnist and as a writer covering the scene, it's not enough just to be, you know, watching the play all the time. You have to be where the people you cover meet and socialize and talk and drink. And that's when you find out, you know, what's really going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely, you know, and it's funny, again, for people who are listening in Colorado and around the country and may not be New York people like you are and I was, you didn't mention Sardi's. Even though Sardi's is still very much there, it's not the hub. It's the tourist theater hub, I guess.
It is, but, you know, I must say I have some real affection for Sardi's, and I do go there, you know, maybe a few times a month, generally to eat with the very old theater guard. I mean, I was there the other day with an old agent friend of mine, and at the table next to us was Florence Henderson, you know, who hasn't been on Broadway since 1912. But God love her. Everybody in that restaurant, well, the restaurant is full of women in their 60s. Right. They all recognized her from, you know, Mrs. Brady on the Brady Bunch. And she couldn't have been lovelier. She posed for pictures with everybody and signs autographs and talks to everybody. So I do like Sardi's, and it is, in many ways, New York has changed so much in the last 20 years, and so many of the great old restaurants that had been hanging on from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s all closed down because, frankly, they couldn't afford the rents that you have to pay here in New York. But Sardi's is one of the last remnants of a New York that is no longer. That's the New York of Dorothy Kilgallen and Walter Winchell and Leonard Lyons, who was the famous New York Post columnist, and Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. And my old friends who remember Sardi's in its heyday say there wasn't a night you wouldn't go in there, and every major literary figure, movie star, theatrical star, they were all Sardi's, and it was all just a very informal party.
Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, that's you know, people still want to feel that. They want a little taste of that old New York, even though New York City is obviously now a theme park.
I think Bar Centrale is kind of the new version of that, because Joe Allen, who's in his 70s now, Joe used to be a bartender at places like P.J. Clark, which were also part of that whole 50s high society New York world, and Joe knew the Stork Club, and he knew El Morocco well, and Bar Centrale is a tip of his hat to the past that he knew. So the bar stools have the zebra covers that El Morocco had, and there are other nods to the ashtrays are Stork Club style ashtrays, although you can't use them because there's no smoking anymore. That was the death of great nightclubs in New York when you couldn't smoke. That really kind of, I think, killed some of the character, because I'm old enough to remember a few of the old places where you'd go in, and you know, there would be a playwright like Lanford Wilson, who died sadly recently. You know, Lanford just in the back with a whiskey and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and that's the way New York was.
Speaking of, since you brought that up, we do want to get to some of the major Broadway and theater news stories of the year. And I was going to save the deaths for last, as it were. But that was kind of a big... We lost some huge folks this year.
Yeah, we did. I went to Lanford Wilson's memorial service a couple of weeks ago, and Edward Albee spoke. And Edward is one of the last. I was trying to think who were the last of that era. And Edward's now 85, I believe. And he and Steve Sondheim, who just turned 80, they're kind of the last of that Broadway era of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Arthur Lawrence, who, you know, goes back to the 40s, died at 92 just a couple of weeks ago. And he was probably the oldest one around. We also lost Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof this year. And we lost Jerry Bach, who wrote the music to Fiddler on the Roof. Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics to Fiddler. Sheldon is still here. In fact, I do a television show here in New York called Theater Talk on on PBS, which is syndicated around the country, so it might air in Colorado, I'm not sure, but you might check the local listings for that. But I had Sheldon on because I wanted to do an interview with the last Fiddler on the Roof guy standing. You know, Robbins is gone, Joe Stein is gone, Jerry Bach is gone, Zero Mostel is gone, and Sheldon is the last person who created that seminal musical. And Sheldon, God love him, agreed to perform to life on my show, and he brought his piano player in and a nice Broadway actress friend of his, and they did to life together, and he got out some old lyrics that had been cut from the show, and so he sang the complete version of To Life that had never been heard of because they altered some of the lyrics for Zero Mostel in the original run.
One thing I do want to ask you about Theater Talk, which has been on the air now, what, about 15 years, more or less?
18 years.
Congratulations on that. Is it ever going to be maybe on the archives on the Internet so people can... Because it has now become, I guess, a treasure trove, just in the way old Tony Award shows are, or the stuff that Neil Berg does. Are there any plans ever to sort of archive them for everybody to use, colleges and things like that?
Yes, well, when I'm stuck in the actor's home out in New Jersey, we'll put them on so I can just relive my youth and my glory days over and over again from the wheelchair. But until that point, we have a few online, and it's a joint production, right, between Theater Talk Productions and the City University of New York. So if you were to go to the City of University of New York television website, you will find Theater Talk. And I think we've got stuff that goes back to 2000 and 2001, but we started the show in 1993, so we still have a lot of stuff that's, you know, has not been put out again. I've got interviews with all sorts of people who are now gone. I have many interviews with the great Peter Stone, who wrote 1776 and Titanic and the movie Charade, who was one of our very first guests and a frequent guest because he was so much fun. I loved having him on. I've got interviews with Fred Ebb, the great lyricist who was John Kander's partner, and they wrote Cabaret in Chicago together. Sure. Fred was a wonderful, wonderful raconteur. So I have a lot of interviews with him. And, yeah, you're right. It has become sort of an archive of Broadway. And with any luck, if it has any value, it'll be my retirement fund.
Well, there you go. Well, we talked about this, I guess, last year or one time when you were on Dave's Gone By, of you've been doing your New York Post column Wednesdays and Fridays for several years now as well. And, you know, you sometimes turn a little wistful and it's like, well, I don't intend to do this forever, but I don't see you quitting that anytime soon. Or, well, how long?
No. I mean, no one's come to me and says, why don't you go off and cover the Barack Obama campaign in 2012. I might try my hand at politics someday, maybe try to make the transition that Frank Rich did so spectacularly at the New York Times, yeah, when he had been the theater critic a long time and then became a political columnist. But so far, the theater still holds my interest. You know, just when you think, oh, I don't think I can sit through yet another crop of shows, you get Book of Mormon, you get a Mother with the Hat, you know, a new play that's up for Tony this year, you get a War Horse. So every year brings some pretty exciting stuff that it's all fun to be, you know, one of the first people to get a look at it and try to celebrate it. Or in the case of Spider-Man, brings a gargantuan flop, which you get a lot of mileage out of that as well.
See, with you, it isn't so much even, I guess, finding a great, wonderful show. For you, it's just, where's the big story? What can I follow like a bloodhound, you know? Which you had.
Well, yeah, I mean, I am a gossip columnist. I'm a news reporter. I write a column that is very much my opinion, but the column is, most of the time, is based on some digging around that I've done. I learned that from William Safire, who was a great conservative political columnist for the New York Times for many years. He's been dead for a few years now. But when I was a young reporter, I met him at a cocktail party, and I just got in my theater column, and I asked him for some advice, and he said, always dig up some news, because if you've got to hang a column around some sort of news. You can play with it, you can take an opinion on it, but have something fresh in there that isn't anywhere else. Because if you don't do that, you're just going to be spouting off your opinions, and you're going to bore yourself in about 3 years and bore your readers in two.
That's very good. That's really good.
I always try to keep it fresh by, you know, calling my sources, what's going on, and there's not always big breaking news on Broadway, but you can find a little something, and from that you can sculpt a column, but you want people to read and say, oh, I didn't know that, that's interesting, that's what's going on there.
Yeah, absolutely, and returning to the idea of the news stories of the year, I've always said that Broadway tends to be, I'm not the only one, really, really cyclical. Like, there was a point a few years ago when there were only one or two new musicals, and Sunset Boulevard had no competition And then suddenly we got this crop of musicals, and then a ton of musical revivals, and then very few. And now this year, the Theater League, the Broadway League, is trumpeting the fact that there are so many new plays on Broadway.
Yep.
Is that a trend?
Yeah, no, we used to complain that the straight play was dead on Broadway, and it was only theme park musicals. And now you've got, War Horse from the National Theater of Great Britain. You've got a terrific play called Mother with the Hat by Stephen Adley Gurgis, starring Chris Rock. Very good play by David Abair called Good People with Frances McDormand. A boring play about a rat called the Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo with Robin Williams, but not every play can be a winner. But, you know, these plays are all, they're about different things. They're intelligent plays. They're funny plays. They're moving plays. And I think that both in terms of musicals and non-musical plays, Broadway's doing very well these days.
Well, that's kind of nice to hear about The Fabulous Invalid. Do you see any trends?
Yeah, well, I would point out to your listeners, all four of them now, because I'm so good, added another one. I have a story in tomorrow's New York Post, which you can get online, which I was trying to figure out very big financial boom we've had on Broadway. If you think about Broadway, Dave, for as long as you and I have been covering it, Broadway used to be the kind of the backwater of the entertainment industry. It was the recording industry and the movies that were the big, big glamorous industries. But over the last 15 years, Broadway has become a multi-billion-dollar industry, and B, in the mainstream of pop culture in America. Kristen Chenoweth sang a song from Wicked the other week on Oprah's final show and on Glee. Now, you don't get more mainstream in American culture than Oprah Winfrey's show, her final show, and Glee, which, by the way, is inspired by Broadway musicals. So, you know, at a time, it used to be Broadway was, you know, revivals of Hello, Dolly with Carol Channing, and nobody cared. Now, Broadway stars like Matthew Morrison and Kristen Chenoweth and Hugh Jackman are in the forefront of American popular culture, and I believe Broadway is that, too. The names of the shows on Broadway are recognized around the world. Mamma Mia, The Lion King, The Phantom of the Opera, Wicked, and now The Book of Mormon. You know, these are juggernauts that everybody knows about.
Was it – well, what started it? Would it have been, God help
well,
us,
Well, I can
cats,
tell you because I laid it out in my story tomorrow. Uh-huh. But I trace it back to –
Disney?
No, it was back before that. I trace it back to 1972. Now, in the 70s, New York City was bankrupt. There was a famous Daily News headline, Gerald Ford to New York City, drop dead. Mm-hmm. Ford was not going to bail out the city. The city was in trouble. Times Square was seedy and full of drug dealers and hustlers and pimps and porn houses, and the Broadway theater was on its last legs. The theaters literally were crumbling. There was no money to salvage these theaters. They were falling apart, and there were very few shows. And there was an organization called the Schubert Organization, which had been founded by the three Schubert brothers in 1900 and had been, in its heyday, the most powerful theatrical enterprise in the world. It was on its last legs, too, and it was being run by the nephew of the last brother. And the nephew was a drunk, and he ran the organization from the second-floor bar at Sardi's in a phone booth because he was bombed all day long. And as he was running it into the ground, and as New York and the theater district falling apart, there were two young lawyers at the Schuberts named Bernard Jacobs and Jerry Schoenfeld. Mm-hmm. And they were ambitious, and they saw that they could push this drunken old Schubert, the last Schubert, out and take control of the organization. So they staged a coup, a very dramatic coup. They got the board on their side, and they pushed Lawrence Schubert Lawrence out. And then they got into this business, and they discovered it was worse than they thought. The Schuberts, they were bankrupt. And they went to Morgan Stanley, their bank, and tried to get a loan. They tried to get a loan from Morgan Stanley to save the theaters, and Morgan Stanley told them, those theaters are worth nothing. They have no value. Well, what happened was, 2 years later, as Bernie and Jerry were struggling to figure out how to pull this thing together, a young up-and-coming director named Michael Bennett went to Bernie Jacobs and said, you know, I'm working on this show about dancers in Broadway musicals, and I'm doing it at the Public Theater, but Joe Papp, who's running the Public Theater, he's run out of money. We don't have any money, and can you help us? And Bernie Jacobs said, you know what, I'll lend Joe the money, Give him, I think he gave him $1 million. I'll lend Joe the money, and if the show's any good, we'll put it in one of our houses on Broadway. Well, the show was a Chorus Line. Yeah. It ran 15 years in the Schubert Theater and made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And I was talking to an old hand at the Schubert Organization the other day, and he said before a Chorus Line, there was no money. After a Chorus Line, there was nothing but money. And Bernie and Jerry used that money to fix up the theaters. They used that money to go hunting for new shows. They used that money to begin the campaign to try to rehabilitate Times Square back in the 70s when nobody thought that could be done.
Right.
And along the way, you know, a few years after Chorus Line, Bernie Jacobs became friendly with a young British producer named Cameron McIntosh, who in 1980 created with Andrew Lloyd Webber Cats, which ran 18 years on Broadway and has made around the world billions of dollars.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And that was the beginning. I mean, Cats is the first global brand name show. And then after Cats, you had Phantom of the Opera and Les Miserables and Miss Saigon. And then you were making a tremendous amount of money. And just when those British pop operas began to fade, you had a very spiffy, you'll remember, revival of Guys and Dolls in 1992,
yeah,
starring Nathan Lane, launched his career. And that's when you saw that Broadway was beginning to regain its footing with Great American Musical Comedy. And I think there's a direct line from that revival of Guys and Dolls, which launched Nathan Lane's career, to Mel Brooks as the producer, which made Nathan Lane a household name 10 years later in 2000. And so you saw Broadway really, really coming along. And in that period, mm-hmm, Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, who'd done Little Shop of Horrors, they went out to Hollywood and they wrote Beauty and the Beast, the movie, right?
Oh, okay.
And that movie came out. Frank Rich said, this is the best musical of the year. And a Disney executive read that and thought, you know, we should put this on stage. And that's how Disney came to Broadway. And Disney got involved not only with Beauty and the Beast, but also the redevelopment of Times Square when they took over the New Amsterdam Theater. And then they launched The Lion King, you know, another worldwide global smash. And then Broadway was off and running.
Let's bring this back full circle. And by the way, thank you for that wonderful history of what's been going on Broadway for like 25, 30 years. It's literally like reading a wonderful textbook, and you're so articulate.
I hope when it does become a book, it's going to be more than a textbook. I hope it'll be a lively, fun, gossipy, behind-the-scenes read of how Broadway was saved and the empire that the Schuberts built.
Well, wow. And actually, let me ask you, Michael, have you never had the impetus to write a book?
Well, I think if I'll do any book, it would probably be the story that I just related to you, because I've always been, you know, I've known the Schuberts a long time, and they're kind of behind-the-scenes players, but they're very, very powerful and very, very successful, and nobody knows a lot about them. And their contribution to saving Broadway is somewhat unsung, I believe. And I just find the story of any empire that's, you know, falling apart and crumbling and then is salvaged and made bigger and better than ever, you know, very much like Apple Computers. You remember a time when Apple Computers was on its last legs and Steve Jobs got in there and totally transformed it into the powerhouse technological monstrosity in some ways that it is today. And so I think that's probably the book I will write one day. And in that rise of the Schuberts, I mean, you also have the rise of Cameron McIntosh and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Lee Paymore and Disney and all the guys who created Hairspray and Stephen Sondheim. So there are a lot of wonderful personalities that you can spice the book, a book about the entertainment industry, up with.
Well, I would be first online to read it, especially if the press agent sent it to me for free. I mean, if it wasn't free, maybe I'd be fifth or sixth on the line.
The only reason you still have a radio show, so whenever you swing through town, you can try to get a couple of free seats up at the balcony.
Well, hell yeah. I mean, come on. I got to get some perks out of this. But, Michael, I thank you also for that, because you hadn't insulted or made a snide comment about me, well, except the listener thing, for the whole interview, and I felt sort of slighted.
Well, I'll stick around for part two, and then I'll rip you apart like I did Spider-Man.
There you go. But
radio show, Dave, is the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark of Colorado.
Well, you know, hey, I wish I was making the money, but you can make...
Spider-Man's not making any money, trust me.
Well, come on, if it's grossing, let's get to that. If it's grossing, let's say, $1.2 million a week, it's got to be breaking even or making some dough at least now.
I'll tell you this, David. The running cost, the weekly running cost of that show, before they pay any royalties, which, by the way, they haven't been paying, and Julie Taymor has taken them to arbitration over that.
Right.
But before they pay any royalties, the running cost of that show is $1.3 million. So if they gross $1.2 million, it means they're losing $100,000 a week.
I didn't realize the nut was so high. I figured it'd be like 800,000 or something like that.
No.
Wow.
No. You've been away from New York too long, Dave.
Michael, we have to wrap it up. But last question: what are you really looking forward to in the next season?
I am looking forward to. I believe there's going to be a revival of Godspell. Mm-hmm. That I'll be curious to see if that show holds up, because I think it has quite a good score by Stephen Schwartz, and I wonder if they can sort of relaunch that the way the Public Theater relaunched Hair this past year. Mm. And I'm also off to London in a couple of weeks, and I'm looking forward to seeing a new version of the old Goldoni play, The Servant of Two Masters, that Nick Heitner has directed at the National Theater. That's supposed to be one of the funniest things around. And I'm going to be attending the opening of Ghost, a musical based on that old Whoopi Goldberg musical, while I'm there.
Okay.
So there are a few things out there, but I don't see anything, frankly, on the horizon that is going to have the impact that the Book of Mormon has had this year. But you never know. I mean, something comes out of nowhere. You know, in 1995, if you and I were doing this show and we thought there might be this little show about these kids that don't want to pay their rent and on the Lower East Side of New York, if we thought that would be a global phenomenon, then we would have been had a very clear crystal ball. What's fun about Broadway is that something you least expect comes out of nowhere and just captures the imagination of the public.
Which Book of Mormon did? I mean, a year and a half ago, the South Park guys are working on a musical. And these days it takes 5 years to get a musical on Broadway. With them,
and nobody was really talking about it. You know, they weren't running around saying, "Oh, be prepared for the biggest hit of all time." And I know deliberately the producer of the show, Scott Rudin, just kept it very quiet. They did some workshops. I had heard from my friends who were in them that it's really very funny. But you know, Scott wasn't looking for publicity. He didn't want to oversell it. He wanted to open it quietly, and if it was good, he knew it would take off. And indeed, it has.
It absolutely has. And I thank you for launching and taking off our I was going for a segue there, but you're so much better at this stuff than I am. Thank you for helping launch this 7th annual Total Theater Tony Show. Michael Regal, everybody read him in the New York Post Wednesdays and Fridays, and also look on your syndicated broadcasts on public television for Theater Talk with Michael and co-host Susan Haskins. Michael, thank you. Thank you for being such a wonderful
And don't
guest.
Forget my article tomorrow, laying out the history of Broadway for the last 40 years in the Post, in a lively and engaging fashion.
As only Michael Regal can be. Michael, thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye, Dave.